Well, let's bring in James Joyce for a minute then.
If you want me.
I've read, Mr. Joyce, that you used this medium. The medium was a woman who was the head of Penn, P-E-N, in the 20s. And according to everything, you used them. I think our academic professors of English humanities, those secular humanists, would be shocked at the book that they voted the most important novel in the 20th century. It was written by a guy who was a paranoid schizophrenic talking to spirits. Am I on the right track to say that you did that?
Yes, but at the time I didn't realize the significance. I didn't really understand. All I could see was the I didn't perceive what I understood the work to become, that I would absolutely die. I had to constantly give my undivided attention to developing the contexts that were put together that actually became the work of Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, now I'd like to just state this. You're saying you did not fully know what you were doing, and if you did know what you're doing, you would have died.
If I didn't continually strive to complete it, because that wasn't an overnight thing. It took a while.
17 years.
And it was developing because it could never get it finished. And how do you finish something that you can't get finished?
But the immensity of that task was what you were dealing with more in the solution and the new questions and the new... You were amazed at the... how it never ended.
That is exactly correct. And if it unfolded, I was the limiting compartment. I was the limitation to the work.
That's right. And you would constantly erase it. And of course, most people, great thinkers who respected you for Ulysses, knew you had totally lost it when they saw the publication of the work in progress. But and you said correct, yes. So, but you allowed that thought to be made about you, and you ignored it and carried on. That was even a greater climbing of Mount Everest.
Because there was no other choice.
It's almost like, well, there must be a... Yeah, it was like, there must be a purpose to this. Because I feel good doing it.
Well, it was a stretch. Because I was forfeiting. I earned respectability in
yeah.
the time. I mean, I was giving up.
That's right.
That work could have turned very differently if what everybody else thought was actually important. Well, or let's say it a different way.
No, that's good.
If I actually gave a damn, it might not ever have been.
That's right. You did keep dying. If we understand dying being indifferent to the opinions of society or your peers, or you say, well, I'm not even here. I love the statement by Cat Beefheart, I'm not even here, I just hang around for my friends. It's something like that, right? I mean, it's a heroic act. You did have the fame from Ulysses to keep getting an income through that to keep doing what you could do, what you did with the wake. That was what you'd earned.
The only way I got through it was from the love of a dog named Bobby.
Named Bobby?
Bobby.
You had a dog?
Named Bobby.
Well, I've always claimed that the book was about me and Carolyn. I haven't noticed that in his biography. It might be in there, but I never noticed that he had a dog. But what about Nora, your wife?
Well, I think she put up with me.
Yes, she lost contact with it. She did not see what the point was.
Because she tried to get my medicine on time.
Yeah, she had a bit of faith in it, or some kind of faith to keep you going. But I want to go back to the experience of the way you kept erasing and moving and having the faith that a new reason for doing what you had just erased would show up. And that's what kept you going? Is that the way to say it?
It was a driving force. I didn't know why it was important. I just knew it wasn't right. Every time I did it, it would be right. I would get it, I would write it down, and it would be right. If you look at between the splits between the fourth and the ninth chapter.
Yeah.
The splits. It's as though it's a whole different thing, but it's not a whole different thing. But you couldn't get there unless you had the division between the fourth and the ninth and even the 12th.
Yes.
Chapters. There's huge crevices that are created, but I couldn't get there and get to the place that it could be recognizable, because what I was seeing could not go to words.
Right, and I mean, you were, in McLuhan terms, once radio came in, we moved into an invisible, non-visual environment of communication, and it seems that at least at some point, not the end product maybe, but at some point, you were translating the experience of living in an electrified radio environment into book. Is that a approximation of what you might have been attempting consciously or unconsciously?
From now, of course, I absolutely would concur.
Yeah.
But it was a very different time when that work was in creation. It was very different. Yes, I had to go to spirit realm. Yes. Actually, I asked the devil a few times what he thought about it. I don't know that I had much confidence in it, but at the same time, I was open completely. And the world thought I was crazy. That's okay. But I didn't care, because my driving force had to be to compile this individual thought and reality and put it together that created that work.
Right. And you would, when you did engage a medium, you would ask about your work.
Yeah.
Right. Just like...
Because it didn't make sense to me at the time.
Yes, like you're watching it leak from you, and you say, why is this leaking from me? What is this?
And I get it, and I spend 8 pages writing it down, and then half of that has to go away. Every time.
Yes.
And then that has to be cohesive and make sense. Otherwise, it becomes a daily log of my hysteria.
Right, so that's right. Daily log of your hysteria, it could have been. You see, what's interesting is that it's different now. People accept channeling more and more in general in Western culture. But back in the 60s, it was rare, not treated the same. But it was insane to do it in the 20s. And I'm thinking of the professors who celebrate you, the Hugh Kenners, the Fritz, whatever his name is, and all those regular academic guys. If they actually thought that you were going to a medium to check out what you were doing and maybe even attempting to talk to the devil, that would be hilarious if they could realize that happened, right? Considering the mindset back then.
Indeed. The work that I didn't regard as important, I didn't get it as I was doing it. It's only as I could validate what I knew I was seeing, knew I was experiencing, and trying to put together so that the cohesive flow could actually be sustainable. That's what the best spirit guides gave me in those days. We went to gypsies lots of times.
What did Nora think you were, well, the why of you doing this?
Well, she thought I'd have the fairs, but I really wanted to be able to talk to me.
Right, she didn't go to the sessions.
Never.
I see. It was not in her liking, her religion, her belief?
It was too foreign. She could accept me validate my direction, however slow.
Right. Now, George Steiner, well-known critic, don't know if he's still alive, he's probably dead, he said that Finnegan's Wake was language about language. One way to interpret that is that you were channeling what thought wanted to say in book form and pointing to other media. It was like you were in a torrent of stuff coming, leaking out of you, and you were trying to surf the wave. That's how I understand you trying to put in order, but it was something bigger than you, as you say now, you didn't know what you were doing. Didn't know what it was.
Yes, that's exactly right. And you've got to know, I was living it.
Yeah.
Every day, it was living it.
It's like...
Well, I didn't know that.
When I talked to the Evergreens about you and with you, what comes to my memory was that you said every sentence written there, I totally know what it means. And you know the average reader, any reader looks at it, it's garble, they can't figure it out. But you were thinking within it, and it made total sense what you wrote.
Well, half of it did, because I write the other half.
But nowadays, if I point to a 20-year-old, I say, how would you express your daily life of instant messaging, emailing, getting phone calls, watching TV, driving around the town, all this mixed media? I said, how would you write that? And they probably couldn't come up with an answer. Then if I showed them a page or two of Finnegan's Wake and I say, this is how you do it, they'd probably get it. And that is what you didn't foresee, that you actually wrote a map, you did a painting, a movie of life in 2009. Would you agree with that?
Yes. Only now. But as it was going, there was no other choice. That was the only point of solace or quieting of my mind that I ever achieved was when I got a paragraph that didn't have to change.
Okay.
That's when it got done. That's the savior. That's the part that could write another paragraph or a half a one or two and get one. You understand that the work itself would be voluminous if we left everything that came. I still think maybe some of the best parts weren't there.
But the point is, what was the point I was thinking as you were saying that is, because you could complete a paragraph, you say, oh, we got another brick in the wall. I now can make a new brick.
No. A paragraph that painstakingly had gone every word, every descriptive adjective, every point of punctuation as the part that didn't get lost. Every part of the part that didn't make it was disappointed. Every other part was lost. Authors in those days weren't judged by what they said. They were judged by what they didn't say.
Right. And but you say a lot, but here's a thought. Because you knew many languages, you're like the present vehicle, J.W., who can't forget anything he's ever heard, because of your voluminous encyclopedic recall of languages, all that hypertexting and intertwining of echoes of different languages was what was expressed, right?
Yes, and the maniacal way that it had effect on the human psyche.
Yeah.
Hopefully. But that seems really easy posthumous to sit and chat about this, because as it was going on, it was as close to salvation and hell at the same time. If I got it, it was salvation. If I lost it, it was hell. Because once it was lost, it was gone. Or if it wasn't gone, it stayed. But
Yeah.
That's why most of my time was erasing.
Now, what's interesting, we think of Ezra Pound, who at the end of the canto says, it doesn't fit, it doesn't connect, something like that. It seemed to be that he was despairing to make the cantos project hold together the way he wanted to. It sounds like he didn't get to the level of completion and acceptance of the undoing that you got to.
Well, he didn't understand the work.
No, he didn't understand your work, but he didn't know that he was doing the same thing with the cantos then.
Correct. Well, apparently, but I mean, it was significant. There's no contest. I mean, it's not that we're pushing against that, but it was just very different. It was very different. But it was, it's almost, well, some school of thought is that they were going to show me how to do it.
And Pound was part of that school, you're saying?
Right, yes.
But don't you see the McLuhan's insight that you, all of you, the vortices, Lewis, Eliot, Pound, Joyce, maybe even Yeats, were devotees of the process of communication and cognition and creation, and were wrestling with this crazy effect that the electric media was doing on people. It drove Europe mad.
Whatever level, because every one of those were at different levels,
yes,
different calibers.
All responding to a similar problem.
Absolutely. And it, not knowing what to do with it. And you got to realize in that moment in time, you have too much out of the way, and you were at the side. You just, in those days, you just didn't publish. It was larger than that. It had to have a beneficial humanitarian meaning.
Yeah.
Or it was just for the funny papers.
Yeah. And it's remarkable.
And made reference to that through the work. It's like, you know, hey, it's another bit of craziness. So going in the crowd, see how you go.
Yes, and I it's like once I talked to Frank Zappa, and he said to me, I don't know why that was published. And I thought, he was responding, like you just said, that it just looked like something for the funny papers. But when I talked to Zappa after he passed on through the Evergreens, it was the opposite thing he meant. I was amazed.
Absolutely.
Now what's interesting to me is that I seem to know exactly what you're saying, but I find it interesting that McLuhan comes along picking up the pieces after the vortices and you guys. And he actually wrapped it up and said, this is what they were wrestling within. And that's a pretty important insight, though I've talked to you through the Evergreens and you said, you said one time, well, you're trying to make my stuff be like McLuhan said it is. And you resisted that. But I'm asking you to, it seems to me you're partly agreeing with the, with some of McLuhan's interpretation of what motivated you.
McLuhan was getting it after the fact.
Yes. Yeah.
It means he didn't. You always have 20/20 vision in hindsight.
Right.
But in the process, that work still today is significant. And that's the part that's amazing. Now, if you want to give Marshall the credit for that, fine.
Oh, wait. I'm not getting it. You said that work is relevant. You mean your work or McLuhan's work?
Finnegan's Wake stands today.
Yes.
And Marshall was able to pick up the pieces and see in hindsight the issue. Okay, wonderful. And that's fabulous and great. But, you know, you honor his position, but it had very little to do with the process.
Yes.
The process is what had to be. If it never got printed, it didn't matter. The goal was that I had to do it.
Get it printed. The goal was to get it printed.
To get it down so I didn't lose it. Because the longer I played with it, the more I erased. The more I erased, the more I lost. The more I lost, the more the less there was. And yet it went on forever. There was still half the song.
Right, but you're saying that the goal was to somehow, within your judgment abilities, say, yes, I'm ready to publish it now.
Well, no, it just, I,
That's right. It just had to be published. He had to finally say, yeah, publish it. Pretend it was done.
Exactly, because it wasn't done. But, and the only regret, if there was a regret, was the parts that I lost. The parts that I erased didn't fit.
Right. Now, what's interesting to me, though, is that you are describing the very thing we're trying to get from the we am here right now. Erasing the perceptions you have today, tomorrow, so that you don't get trapped in a limited way of looking at things.
Exactly correct. And some call that schizophrenia.
That's right. Well, you have to be careful how you interact with other people. I'm not going to go running down to the pool tomorrow go into the shower and see somebody and say, hey, you know what? We don't need to eat. It's not the right context. Well, maybe it is, but I'm not inclined to do that. And
from where we are now, drawing a parallel from then, if I could have cleared my mind and realized that what I was writing, the thoughts that I was connecting with actually what I was living in response to the asking that was in my environment, I could have peaceably made a fabulous work and continued on in perpetuity, because it would have taken the angst away from my process that I was carrying. So again, I couldn't get it done. I couldn't get it right. I couldn't get it to me. Couldn't get it to flow. I had a hard, miserable time trying to make it not be, as you say, gibberish.
That's right. So what you're saying is Finnegan's Wake, the published artifact, is a failure in large.
Not complete.
Not complete. But you did get it done, because for people today, it's complete enough.
It's all they can stand.
Yeah, it's all they can stand. And so when you've been on my mind the last day or so as I talked to the I am here, because the phrase blocks of thought that our vehicle says happens in this condition he's in trance, that reminds me of you, like showing blocks of thought on the page.
You've studied that work, have you not?
Yep.
Don't you find the punctuation rather interesting?
I find the bravado to make a work ridiculously punctuated, but once you get to know the work, the punctuation is correct.
Well, precisely, but doesn't it seem odd that the way the sentence structure was created, that the like you say, the hyper punctuation is like there's things that are missing?
Yes. The book makes punctuation irrelevant.
Well, but it actually, if you really wanted to have some fun, go back and look at the actual punctuation and see if you can pick out the parts that are missing to fill in the gaps, because that's the crazy part. But I couldn't put it all. But if you look at the punctuation, I rarely change that part. And
you really changed what part? The punctuating?
And if you notice, if you look, I don't know if the biography picked up on it or not, but I know I lived it. There were three editors that just absolutely just almost threw it in the garbage.
Yeah.
Good. Because they couldn't get there from that element alone. And I wouldn't budge. Either print the way it is or forget it. Or I'll work on it some more.
Yes.
Two more years.
Now, what did you say about 2 more years? Because it was, you only lived another 2 years.
That's what I said. What if it's only 2 more years? I can wait 2 more years.
What do you mean if it's only 2 more years?
Either print it the way it is, or I'll work on it some more, even if it was but for 2 more years.
I see, yeah. But the thing is, the punctuation, you're saying, if I go and look at all the different drafts, the punctuation is constant. But
pretty
what?
Constant. Now, they changed some of it just because some of it. very obvious blocks, and I couldn't get past it because the punctuation was very important, not because it was important, but it was just my only places. Did you realize that I would spend a day and a half on
this? Oh, I know that. Yes, it's a famous quote. Yeah. I had a great day. I finished the sentence.
You can't believe it. It will tear your very psyche out of whack because why could it not just be fluid? Well, it was fluid, but the fluidity would not have ever come together. It would have been the Encyclopedia Britannica.
But from the perspective of the non-physical that you have now looking at your life, you probably could see that underlying it all was a state of creative bliss.
Well, it wasn't bliss when I was going through it. It was contrast.
Yeah,
never was there ever one chance or one thought that I couldn't not do that.
That's right. That's what I mean by the... It kept you interested in life. It kept you thinking. That is the unconscious bliss you did not feel.
It was a drive. And I didn't understand at the time, but it was a drive. And I didn't know why. I questioned that any time. I didn't know why, but there was never an opportunity not to do it.
There was never an opportunity not to do it. Yeah. I mean, it always had to be worked on.
It had to be.
So, do you think Michelangelo felt that when he was doing the famous Sistine Chapel painting? It was a struggle. Is it like that with all great art?
No, not necessarily. If you're a painter who paints, you could be painting masterpieces, or you could be painting shutters on the outside of a house. It's just how you see it. It's the part you stand.
Right, but
that's all I can stand.
Right, I just need to ask Carolyn something. Now, you're probably going to go to bed. What do I do when this session is over? How do you stop the recording? You just hit the thing.
Just
leave it, and then you'll organize it tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay. Don't you think this is interesting talking to James Joyce?
Fabulous.
And it's like if I did die, I'd have this kind of conversation with him.
Yeah.
The way you were talking, it's like just two guys sitting around talking about it, and that level of casual intimacy is what's happening in this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that, it was only slightly that way when I did the hour with the Evergreens with James Joyce. Do you remember the session through the Evergreens we did in 1995?
I do, and the one thing about that particular interaction was it was not, there were breaches. We'd have communication, but you never got all of it. Some of which did all of it.
I think I'm getting more now, right?
Well, it became frustrating to me because it was just like the damn work.
Now, is that because of the particular medium?
Well, I don't know. I would say yes, but at the time I was thinking, well, this is not unusual. This is the way I've been 17 years working on the same thing and chatting with you an hour about it is no different. So, but what the evolving portion of that is because now looking at how it has affected the spirit realm that I was so concerned with verifying as it was being created, thinking I was stone cold crazy because everybody told me I was stone cold crazy. Coming to that place that this is, you know, this is mindless. What are you doing and why are you doing it? You know, you could be laying bricks and do better. You know, there's a standard joke back in Churchill's day of you're not much of a statesman, but you're a pretty good brick mason. You just build walls all over the place. And that was just comical because I'm thinking, well, no matter
Well, you know, one of the key lines in all your work is Balbus is building a wall or making a wall.
That's a borderless wall.
Yeah, and that's that is in, I think, the portrait. And the wall, you're still playing with that theme, you just by your statement now.
It's absolutely correct. And now there's no limitation, and nothing is lost.
Nothing is lost over there.
Nothing is lost. There are some works that are working here that are tapping into things, and they don't go to seances anymore, okay? Because that was the day. But they can get for a second that their processes can be accepted even if they care if they're accepted or not. And that some of the rage that you see, now Marx would have a field day with this tubing things where people can stand naked and get on the internet and stuff. That's just kind of amazing. Because if I tried that, they wouldn't be committed.
But
now they pay money to advertise to watch somebody's clothes falling off. That's the biggest thing I've ever seen.
But wait a minute. You're saying over, I missed the point. You said over there people are creating works that are tapping into things awake, or I don't think that's what you meant.
There are those in physical.
Yeah.
Who have taken, they've probably never even heard of it, Bob. I mean, be real. Not everybody's read.
That's right.
That understand that this maniacal, crazy person who had some obscure thoughts and transitions that got down on a piece of paper somewhere that took the liberty to boldly do that on the verge of insanity and allowed them the ability now to be much freer in the conceptual realities that become their mantras or their works. Same thing was true with Ansel Adams, the photographer.
Yeah.
Same thing is true. It's not new. I mean, we had color, I think, when he did his work, but his big thing was black and white, because that's what he saw. And that became okay. He did indeed participate in the work. But as far as reading and thinking, this guy's crazy, if he can do that, I should be able to take pictures of whatever I want to. Became quite famous before he was visible.
Right. Did you say he was aware of your work?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now that I've thought this for many years. That as you have YouTube, where everybody's one-upping each other on outrageous craziness. Well, you got the head start in the game by being the most ridiculous crazy thing ever, bending its wake. And so it inspired as a standard of craziness, even though they didn't. They just said, "Well, that's the furthest crazy thing anybody could do." This spinning his wake book. I don't know what it means, but I think if I'm acting crazy, I'm not as crazy as Mr. Joyce.
Well,
it's something like that standard.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, that's very close. Now you got to realize. In physical, we'd be having a way different conversation, because it was personal in those days.
Yeah, you would not admit what you're saying to me now in person.
I couldn't believe it. It was personal. I mean, it was, you got to realize that my life was a daily fight just to stay in what society would say is acceptable.
Yes, the Evergreens said that you were either smoking marijuana or doing cocaine, and you pretended, since that was not acceptable, that you were drunk.
Yeah.
That's a parallel deception of the struggle.
Well, there was a great deal of gin that went through the process, too.
Right. Was it marijuana or cocaine?
No, there was some hash.
Hash, okay.
And gin. Gin was my favorite.
But it was more acceptable to be drunk than to be stoned.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Did you find you get interesting blocks of thought, inspiration on the hash?
No. There was a frenzy. The whole thing was a frenzy.
Yeah.
Those moments would allow you to actually come down and relax.
Ah.
And go with it.
Yeah. Now, you know,
I'm saying that it's a path least travel because it wasn't an overnight thing.
Right. If you recall, you told me through the Evergreens when I said that I was going to play a tape of our conversation to the Phoenix Wake Society of New York. You said, watch the different reactions. I think you did a little inventory of the types of reaction. Well, I went and played it, and of course, what you had prophesied happened, the different types of reactions. But I was wondering if you observed that evening when I played the tape for them.
Yes, the lady in the second row.
Yeah.
With the red dress, kind of heavy set.
Yeah.
That her eyebrows kept kind of going over the top of her head.
Yeah.
I thought I was going to die.
You laugh at it. You're dying of laughter, but let's look at what's funny. What's funny is you're watching the impossibility of human communication and also watching the person in no way believing that I was talking to you.
Absolutely. And I thought she was going to slip the stitch a couple of times because it was just all she could bear.
Yeah, like...
all she could bear.
But isn't that... I put her through that tension. Isn't that what art does? And just like your book did that to people, playing the tape.
Some people.
Yeah, not everybody. The other people who don't know of your work get tension other ways. Get that state of being where you can't take it. I can't take this much more, but I'll still put up with it, but I can't take it. Which is exactly, in a microcosm, the way you felt as you did the book.
Best question that you haven't asked yet, and I'm waiting, but I'm going to give it to you anyway, is what was the motivation? Why did I start Phoenix Wake? It wasn't what it was going to be called, by the way, but...
No, not that time. The motivation was... It may have even... Through the Evergreens, this was said to me. The motivation was about the effect of the book Ulysses. Something to do with Ulysses.
Well, if you look at the punctuation, that may answer that question. Yes, that is a possibility. And yes, you've got to realize 10,000 times a day, I had to deal with this. But the girth of it became, if I don't, what will we do? Because you realize at that stage I was all alone. The crowd all alone, I don't know the difference, fighting for what limited was my sanity. That was the only piece that came, and that was the biggest source of my frustration, by the way, but it was the only way that I could cease or stop bleeding, as you call it, or the fear of loss of what I wasn't getting.
Yeah.
The only way I could do it. Basically, the crazier it got, the harder it was, but the better the outcome.
Yes. Now, Ulysses gets published in 22 by Sylvia Beach, and it's a sensation among what T.S. Eliot called the 3,000 literate people in Europe, or sophisticated.
Oh, yes. If we have to go through that damn Halloween one more time, that more than I can say.
but the thing is, it was a sensation in a small world. Over time, because of the fact it was suppressed, banned, it made people want to read the dirty parts or whatever. Is it the effect of that book, your fame, which was part of the pressures that you felt and that you could use to solve your dilemma?
same way they had the same trouble with the catcher in the rye.
Yeah.
Same deal. So the answer is yes, and that's where you can draw your only parallel to the catcher in the rye.
Because what it, how he disappeared from the public. Because it got to a level of success that he wasn't prepared for, or the effects of it.
That is exactly correct. And I never enjoyed that process. I didn't, was still frustrated because I didn't think it was complete.
Ulysses.
Yeah.
Yeah. The, it seems that Bob Dylan went through the same experience. He became way more famous, and the effects of it were so different from what he thought he was going to do or have, that he became quite disturbed by it. Do you know about the case of Bob Dylan?
Indirectly. I think the motivation was different. If you draw the parallel, I'm not quite sure how you get there, but if it's from the angst that you have to go through, he had the same angst that I had, only I had in the authorship.
Yeah.
Not afterwards.
That's right.
It flowed, and then it was a mess. Well, mine was a mess. Then it flowed, and then I was dead. So it didn't matter.
What it is that one of the main factors of 20th century life was mass celebrity. And that was not the case in the 18th or 17th century, I don't think. Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's an interesting point. Don Thiel, the best student of Marshall McLuhan, some of us think, he thought that you were, one of the levels of obscuring it was to deal with the, to not get into the censorship problem you had with Ulysses. Was that a thought in here?
If I wrote what I thought,
right, and it also was scary because no one knew where the Nazis and all that was happening in 34, 35 was going to go, right?
That's correct. And even bigger than that was to decide that you literally spent all this energy on this work and have a committee of two decide if it was worth the paper or not.
Yeah. That's what was the case?
Was the driving force of my
struggle.
Battle,
yeah.
Struggle, it was a battle.
And with those, who was the guy? Bernard Cerf, who ran Vanguard? The guy who published Finnegan's Wake in the United States. Bennett Cerf, C-E-R-F. Alfred Kazin told us a few years ago in New York City that he was a young author. He goes into the office of Bennett Cerf. There's sitting the newly minted published Finnegan's Wake. And the publisher, head of the company, Bennett Cerf, says to Mr. Kazin, "What am I supposed to do with this?"
Exactly.
And he published it. I don't know, did... Sylvia Beach, who was the first to publish it? I mean, you have the Paris publishing, I guess Sylvia Beach did it, or was it Elliot? Elliot's Faber and Faber? I can't remember who did it first. Maybe Faber and Faber.
Faber and Faber first, but that was a very limited printing.
Yes.
That was not huge. Matter of fact, I don't think they paid all they were supposed to pay, but it really didn't matter at that point. I was pretty gone by then.
Yeah.
But...
So Vanguard, the American printing was bigger.
Yes, and that was the beginning of Harper Press.
Oh, okay.
And they actually made the most money that I made.
Yes. Now you did do the corrections after it came out. You went through it again.
That's it.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, through the Evergreens, they said that you reread Ulysses near the end of your life, and you said, "Damn, I got it right." But you do not feel that about thinning his weight, even though it's pretty good.
Well, like I say, the only reason it's passable is because in those days it was judged more by what it didn't say than what it did say. I mean, because everything was fallacious in those days.
Yeah.
When you can make reference to breath, they think you're, you know, homosexual or something.
Yeah. So you're saying everything was judged by how well you didn't pull the porn in.
Potentially, yes. And that was not necessarily so much porn. It was just porn then.
Yeah. Porn then, yeah. And, okay, so have you, while you sit there in the astral plane, wherever you are, well, no, you're right here.
That's right.
Do many... I'm interested in, I imagine, Hugh Kenner, McLuhan, all the famous Joyce scholars who I've read, do they seek you out, or you can't even think in those terms for your dimension, do you have conversations with them?
No, it's a little different than that. What happens is when you drop the physical,
yeah.
Okay, you realize immediately that you came from something,
yeah.
In your words, but when you go back to the same something that you were, what happens is all of the doubt and fear and mental instability is cleared up. What that means is I really wasn't crazy, I just thought I was.
Yeah.
When all that is dropped, then what happens to the part of me that were, that are now the non-physical part that's now the dead state, stone cold dead. And I hate that tombstone, by the way. Come into a place where it becomes a homogeneous grouping. So the individual ideas that were me have faded into the individual parts that were Marshall and the individual parts that were the other Peter, all of different folks were then blended together, and you can have cognizant thoughts regarding it and laugh over most of it. So it becomes an uncensored flow of information. Now I officially can tell you that nothing is lost.
Right, at least in that dimension, and more...
The only dimension there is.
Right, so nothing is lost, and therefore, Marshall and them get to enjoy the fuller Finnegan's Wake.
Well, correct, and the flow of information is now endless.
Yeah, and it's slightly irrelevant. The thoughts that Marshall had and questions he had about your work, in a way, become irrelevant once he's passed into the non-physical and he's interacting with you on a whole other level.
Rather than setting his whole caliber of integrity on the platform to discuss it, it becomes now, if there is a directional thought process, you have fear, it's instantly developed.
And it doesn't even, I mean, you ever even say the personality survives death, but isn't it a larger McLuhan talking to a larger Joyce?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and there are new ones. There are fresh ones. It might even be crazier than they thought I was, or I thought that I was, that are coming out now that are, make my stuff.
Yeah, but what is that desire to do crazy stuff? Is it an assertion of the self?
It's freedom, of liberality that you can express, not worry or have any disdain of anybody thinks about anything. That was something we never had the privilege or capacity to even consider, let alone enjoy.
And that's an aspect of what I call the post-information society. Is nobody's paying attention to anybody else anyways.
Marshall 101.
I've talked, you've mentioned this through the Evergreens, that in the 50s you started to notice McLuhan's work, took an interest in it. With that, let's say that Marshall had the advantage of foresight. So then you read it, you start to become aware of Marshall's work, however it is from your perspective, and you say, oh, that is partly what was going on. And so this person in the physical, McLuhan, is helping explain to you what you did.
It's a stretch, but okay.
Yeah, I mean, not totally. The personality will disagree, but the thing is that you probably were interested in the way he came up with a new way of looking at what had been done by you guys, you and Pound and Lewis.
Yes, but sometimes, though, the developed concept that you know from Marshall actually came from us in the non-physical. Where do you think you got all this post-information ideas anyway?
Well, did he get that in his unconscious? Did he go to a medium? Or it's just, he thought it was his creativity and he wasn't aware it was coming from you people.
He wouldn't have it any other way, but that it was his direction, his thought, his creation, his reality, and everybody who didn't see it his way were not qualified to listen to him either.
So,
right?
I agree totally with that. I knew Marshall. That's exactly his personality. Now, I would say that as I tomorrow will wake up and have thoughts, I could start saying, did Joyce give me that? Did Pound? Or did Marshall? I don't want to get distracted by that. So
you shouldn't, because it all becomes homogeneous.
That's right.
I can do this for you. You can play with it a little bit. When you go to the market, you buy a gallon of milk. Did that gallon of milk come from one cow or did it come from a bunch of cows?
Yeah, I wouldn't know.
Well, it doesn't matter, but the truth of it is that it comes from a bunch of cows because all that milk is put into one batch and then sold by the pound and then divided out and put with others when they think they pasteurize it, homogenize it, and all that stuff. They kill it with milk, but regardless, it's all a grouping of a whole of the milking cows. So you may have a little part of all, or you may have a little part of just one, but you can't delineate that way. You've got to leave it as if the milk that I'm getting is coming from all the cows. Then it becomes more fluid.
Right, and so when the IM was telling me I was the leading edge of creation, when I get up in the morning, I think, or thoughts occur to me, I let them flow, I don't make the mistake that I'm thinking them, I'm just enjoying what's being thought, and I can consider that everybody is, I'm picking up on what everybody's broadcasting, and to the degree... including the non-physical as well.
No, not including, only the non-physical.
Okay, so I'm actually channeling consciously, if you call channeling getting communication from the non-physical.
And if you fail to do that, from my experience, what happens is you get caught in the net gallery. You start including what they think out of the process.
Yeah.
You got to leave the peanut gallery out of it.
Right. Now, Walter Bowert said through the medium here in the first session that was not recorded that in regards to my radio show, don't want to go too far ahead and lose too many people. Lose too many because a lot of people, they can't get it right away. There are some who can and want more, wacky Bob, but you might want to consider the ones that can't get it and slow down for them. That is what one is always juggling, right?
I had that problem.
Yeah.
And I had that problem probably more than most folks.
Yeah.
But then I would start getting crazy and most folks I would be and it would make a difference. But don't lose your message, but you also don't have to be so out there that you run everybody off in the shooting gallery. Because you can do that just because you got bullets. It's not a good excuse to shoot yourself in the foot.
Yeah.
Therefore, be mindful of your audience as best you can, knowing that what you just said was more than likely absolutely probably the case. But if you can temper what you're actually describing just as, I can have two sentences that made it pornographic, but you wouldn't want pornographic to be more on commercial on your regular TV now than the worst thing I ever described. But if you can be mindful of how you're presenting, what you're presenting, a larger audience, you have a much better chance of actually catching someone's attention, be able to communicate with them such a way that they don't turn you off immediately, even though you have marvelous things to say. Now, am I saying change your story? No, keep it there how you want it to be. But you can convey it in such a way that you don't run everybody off right in the shoot. Some of them that want more are going to get more anyway. Those that don't might have an opportunity to just sort of stop in a little bit that would allow them to make come into a tactile understanding or a visceral understanding of what you're actually trying to communicate. That affects the mean in the opposite direction because then they come into a place where they go, we don't know what the hell he's talking about, but I think I'm going to hang around a little bit just to make sure I disagree. If they spend their time making sure that they disagree, you've got it booked. But if they don't even give it a chance to be wrong, then you've lost because it's for naught.
Yeah.
If that is your want.
Yeah.
If not, then screw them. Do whatever the hell you want to. It doesn't matter.
Right. Now, there was the direction. It'll come back another way. What do you think of Mr. Joyce, think of the thinning of the veil happening now?
It's been going on for a long time. It's just not new.
Ah, okay.
It's not new. It has been going on for some time. It's the first time. So the part that is new is the people in physical form that are interacting with the non-physical part that is the spells. The division, we did this, the division between the mind, body, and soul.
Yeah.
You remember that?
Yeah.
The division between mind, body, and soul now all of a sudden becomes easier and more complacent to understand that non-physical part is the key. That you now, in physical, are just now coming into the place of recognizing that this indeed can apply and work for you. And once that happens, then you've got the answer to move heaven and earth, which is what everybody seems to be in your time frame now, seems to be asking for. They don't want to stay here, they want to know how to stay themselves.
Yeah. Do you see an unforeseen effect that one might be concerned about when cold play becomes an environment? Cold play or cold fusion?
I see the barnacles on the ship. I see the process that they have to go through to remove the barnacles off the ship. And I see after that, because in the place the barnacles just fall off, you no longer have to go through the process. An example is how you have to find out that there are barnacles on your boat.
You won't have to do that.
That's correct. Now that becomes now a entity. Are there still barnacles?
You ever even said that in 100 years from now, everything that we could see in our room, this was in 1999, would have disappeared, and there'd be no disease, very little disease, no hunger, people live longer. You know, the projection from 50 years ago, say, people fantasize better today, but back then, the reality they ever... Right, no, that's what I was going to say. Do you agree? Do you see what the Evergreens see? Quite a successful humanity.
Well, no, if left to your own design, you have the ability and capacity to go anywhere, to do anything, to, as a kid, play with a stick and have great joy, where now you have to have everything. So it's got to talk to you and talk back and do your homework for you and control every aspect of your experience, or you don't find it engaging in the physical now. Because this information highway has gotten so busy with cars that now traffic's not a problem because you're watching TV in the car. You're listening to the radio and emailing somebody and ordering your supper and checking on the traffic. And you can do all that. You could be home and be done with it already. But instead, everything is such an engaged perception that the imagination actually is there. But most often it dwells through all the input that is in vehicles, the input that you have. The most amazing thing that I've noticed lately is you look for, since Alexander Graham Bell has been in the telephone, people were on party lines, they were on one telephone. If you had your own private line, that was a big deal. And to the point where area code would last for 100 years. Now, their area codes, which means every possible combination numbers in a area code and then a dialing range or exchange has filled up, and now people who barely had one line on a street and the party line they were sharing, those folks now have 15 to 20 lines each. Well, if you go in for 50 or 100 years, how is it now keep making the 15? And if there's four people in your house and you have 15 lines, who's talking on all those lines?
Yeah, to me, I see that technologies have expanded, taking on a life of their own, and are communicating among themselves, and surplus human flesh is on the sidelines trying to move through the crowd.
Well, yes, but actually what's transpiring, from my opinion, okay, you're still talking to me, from my opinion, what's happening is, instead of using the ability to be paranoid, schizophrenic, and write it anyway, they are using it to use the information to slow down the demons in their mind. And that never works, but try as they might. Now the only information or imagination that they can enjoy is the one that someone else has to control. And they seem to like it that way.
Okay, you come to a good point. First of all, when you spoke through the Evergreens, you were saying, and your present statement sounds consistent with this, you were quite upset the way media had wrecked the imagination. You thought reading and writing were the most important thing, and people were gradually losing that. That was the destructive meaning message in Finnegan's Wake. You take that, parallel with, juxtapose it with the Evergreens saying that maybe distraction isn't a problem. Maybe it's a good thing we get distracted. I think the oscillation between the services of constant distraction from the demons of your mind to your celebration or maybe nostalgia for a kind of imagination, that's the dialectic of contention here. right?
Yes. And I was on the leading edge. I just didn't know it then. I didn't know. But I didn't know it then.
But what was odd, it's like you were possessed. You were schizophrenic. You were obsessively building sandcastles almost. You're supposed to have a family and raise your kids. You could run down the beach building sandcastles. That's pretty crazy behavior. And you never knew that would be a meaning. You got away with it, and that you yourself did not know that it would be meaningful activity in retrospect.
Right. But I wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah, what was it, do you think, drove you?
The imbalance of my thought processes in my mind. The driving part of how many sandcastles do you need and why did they last? And the harder I worked on it, the faster it washed away. And then I decided that the problem was with the universe and the way the moon moved the tides to wash my sandcastles away. And that was all occurring within the prime premises of my mind.
Yes, and yet, there was something in your being that knew it was worthwhile what you were doing.
Well, and what I found out after I was done, which I wasn't done, but when I at the point that it was finished or printed or printed, I had done it so often that I'd actually become to rely on the imbalancing balance that came from the process.
Yeah.
And otherwise, you couldn't have ever gotten there from here.
Yeah.
Process is what I live for, even if it did take 2 days to do it. That was the right sense.
Yeah. And I'll have to think more about the punctuation point. I see now that it looks odd because chunks were taken out that the punctuation was designed around. But the...
an unusual use of semicolons, if you agree.
Yeah. No, I haven't looked at the book in a few years. Say, I don't know, I stopped studying it thoroughly in New York City in 2000. So I only glanced at it occasionally since then. But I do remember noting the punctuation. That actually is what stands out, maybe, I don't know, for most readers. But for me, was watching and observing the strange punctuation. Yeah. Did you want... That is not what you intended? Or it was?
It happened.
Yeah, it just happened the way... Now, that's why I like George Steiner's statement. It's language talking about language. You were the bee that distribute the pollen for the flowers being language, and you were just an instrument within the process, but there was a whole other level of communication, to the point that on page 254, you describe Marsha McLuhan to the T. Have you ever thought about that? It's Marsha McLuhan.
I lived it.
You mean you wrote it? In other words, you saw that previous writers described you, or previous art pointed to you.
Well, with a little help from girls.
You mean their enthusiasm, or Sylvia Beach, or what?
We call it medium.
Oh, yeah. No, it's just that when you say your dog was Bob, named Bobby, since I'm now the leading edge of creation, I've inherited the Joyce mantle, I see that you predicted me by having your dog, your baby, Bobby, named Bobby. That is the weird part of language and what people say and do from the bird's eye view, the God's eye view. God is watching the entertainment of what people are saying to each other and more tuned into what the language is saying and the weird synchronicities that are set up and enjoying it.
Yes, and you got to realize that the divine God that you make reference to is us and part of you.
Yeah.
And part of the past, part of the future, because it always is. So if it can be created or destructive, then it always is. But that becomes the mantra.
YouTubers?
YouTubers, and even T.S. Eliot is pretty hard.
But it's just, I've looked at Marshall's notes of his copies of Finney's Wake, and he noted that Mears McLuhan referred to him. Now, he has a great statement about you. He said, James Joyce waited for the slips of tongue and the slips of language, and they'd always point out a pattern. And I find myself today in the seamless web of media, in a post-information society. There are people who know my work know that major movies point to me. That's language. Talking, and language includes all these media, in a seamless web, pointing to what's coming. Just like you described McLuhan on page 254. Were you aware of that linguistic complexity clairvoyance when you were working?
Yeah. I think I spent 3 weeks.
What page number is that?
254.
Oh, yes. And but you're saying you, like me, had help from the spirits. Yeah. Are there many of us, let's call us as a kind of artist that uses medium, are there many of us that I'm not aware of?
Yes, everybody actually does. They just may or may not recognize it.
Well, yeah, everybody's intuiting. But are there many...
Well, now, you're kind of thinking that, but maybe not. Some people hit the wall and going to the left and hit another wall and going to the left. That hasn't changed. But the reality is if they can come to a place where they draw the inside out, which is where the great words come from, they can come to that position. Then what happens is they relax and expose. That becomes sweet.
What was the last syllable?
Sweet.
Yes. Isn't it interesting how the phrase sweet, maybe more among young people, became a popular way of expressing delight over the last 10 years?
Well, they did that before the Civil War too, didn't they?
Did they go sweet if something interesting happened?
Put enough sugar on the tea, they did.
But I see it as, from Carol's point of view, we have such a sugary world of mixed media distraction that the young kids, it's all just sugar now. And that's why that's part of their world, to say sweet. It's almost like saying cancer. To the degree we look at the disservices of the complex distraction you were describing 10 minutes ago.
And they used to say, lag play.
Yeah.
Play.
Yeah.
Was always that creative imitation human condition that everybody does.
Those are carefully chosen words. Creative imitation human condition. Right? Okay, so the slips of tongue. What is it with Wyndham Lewis? Did you get really pissed off at him, or is that just rumor?
There were basic misunderstandings that were pretty, more publicized than I'd care for.
Yeah.
But it was just wrong, mostly. But I guess you have the right to be wrong. But you can't come into the place. You can communicate if I was more open to communication, or you can hang with a shotgun. That was thoroughly considered.
Taking them out.
Well, I wouldn't be taking them out. That'd be a pleasure.
Yes, but the thing is, McLuhan writes in the 50s, and this is just McLuhan, that Wyndham Lewis was the first to use media en bloc, ENBLOC. He said Joyce and Eliot did it on a smaller scale. To the degree that McLuhan is celebrating the evolution of media awareness, would you agree that Lewis contributed more than you?
I don't know.
Right. he did in the 60s say that Finnegan's Wake was the greatest guide to media. You're aware that he flipped, so to speak.
But that's what I say. Time will tell. There's folks that the peanut gallery is Washbish. They'll turn on you.
Yeah.
They, you know, like one minute you're the savior of the world, and the next minute you. How many times is it flipped between Christ and Antichrist?
Yes.
Every time you turn around, it's either God or the devil. Or what was the devil then becomes God, or vice versa.
That's what Obama's going through.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they, if you put your stock, if I had to have the public approval for my little work, then I would have actually never finished it because I would have never gotten that from you.
Yeah.
You got to get to a point after a little while where you just don't give a damn what anybody else thinks. There's none of me think.
Right. Now, don't you think, Lewis definitely had that attitude, seemed to me. Don't you think there was a bit of a put-on in his contrariness to you?
Well, we got along. We just agreed to disagree. And the anything that was a lark, you got to understand in those days, to make the paper was a good day. So if you had a skew in, if you call it journalism or journalistic circles, the more they were talking about you, the more books you were selling.
So it was good that you and Lewis had this public spat because it got people into it?
Most of that was created, and we did have our disagreements, obviously, as you well know.
Yeah.
It was also good for business.
Yeah.
More for him than me, but still.
Why was it more for him? Because he didn't do that well selling.
Well, that was his biggest triumph.
Yeah. Oh, it worked. If he didn't have that, he would have had nothing.
Exactly.
Yeah. You had a little more slack on that point. You had...
Well, I didn't care.
Yeah. But you did have a bigger reputation or were more well-known than him, I think.
But I didn't care.
Right. You think he cared?
Oh, it was his life's work.
To care.
To hit me.
But...
Attractive.
Well, did you, in Finnegan's Wake... One of the meanings and levels of the twins was you and him. Because you're born the same year, both could do more than one thing. He could paint and write. You could sing and write.
And bitch.
And bitch.
More than he did any of the others.
Well, he bitched, but did you bitch?
No, I was just lazy to bitch. I didn't care.
But I'm talking about the twins, the similarities.
Well, but that's the context of the story, not you had to have a balance. What you call yin and yang.
Yeah.
And that just becomes fun. But after that, it was just much ado about nothing.
Right, so that the twinning can mean yin yang, not exactly the same.
Well, and if you look at the whole context of what I was actually conveying, there was as much in that the twinning could be within the one person.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the twinning can be not two individuals, one that you're having a disagreement with. You could be, I've spent many days, more days than disagreeing with him, with disagreeing with myself.
Yeah. Now that's part of the, in some ways, Finnegan's Wake is a wrapping up of what literate man could express about how the internal twin divide was manifested publicly in different ways. And they intertwined, the inner and the outer, and they merged, and yet there were differences, which is the conversation we had 2 hours ago at the beginning. How much of me being the leading edge of creation in my own mind is affecting some shared zone? That's an ongoing, what McLuhan called the drama of cognition.
And it also comes in the same place of the mass consciousness effect of that same process. 30 years ago, couldn't even say the things that you hear on regular radio, TV, whatever anymore.
Yeah.
And that evolution took place within the twin through the sensors, but it was still affecting the twin. Who said that it's okay to say fuck, and it wasn't okay to say fuck before? or what changed?
Well, McLuhan would say that we were gradually moving into a post-information society, so that's what changed.
Well, what does that do with fuck?
Well, can you say fuck in the air? Not, well, some places, but WBAI can't do it because their target is radical, so they have to toe the line because they'll get sued, which would kill their little station.
Indeed, and no contest, but I'm just saying that whole process, give it a minute. They used to say it was the Lord Rhett Butler liked to lost it. Clark Gable liked to lost it with saying damn.
Yeah. Okay, so you're saying that it's not an issue now, the fuck point?
It's a less issue.
Yes. And McLuhan would say that's because speech has become a minor medium compared to the ESP, proprioceptive, gestural media we live in.
Okay, and I'd have to simplify that. I'd have to simplify that. Simplify that meaning. It's not what you say, it's what you mean.
Okay, it's what you mean.
What you mean. Because now when you say something, what we would call in a bad vernacular, it's what do you mean, not what you said.
Okay, so what do you mean seems to me that people aren't too sure, since if you're broadcasting, you're targeting all kinds of different people, we don't know who you are targeting when you say something.
That's why you're able to get away with it more so now than
yes.
You were in my day, because everything was more literal. That's why my eraser ran out before my pencil.
Yeah, but the point is that people knew who you were targeting. Now you can't. So that's what they, when they go, what do you mean? They're saying, what audience are you criticizing or targeting or praising? That's what it is.
Handling or warring or
yeah.
Praising.
Yeah. Or praising. So when you, so what was it? It's not, what was the first part before? What do you mean? Not what you're saying, it's
not
what
you
mean.
Saying, it's what you mean. And if that evolves, or I say dissolves, you can say more things that are not necessarily apropos and no one's offended.
Yes. And what, the only reason they would, monitor what you say is to find out if you mean or are targeting a government building or something to blow up. In other words, you're a terrorist. If you don't mean that, you can say all that you want.
Correct.
Yeah. And so we're like cavemen who language, we are very concerned about what all us crazy human beings in a post-information society are intending to hurt. Who are you intending to hurt? What scale? At the same time, there's all kinds of violence going on, isn't there?
Of course. So, it seems that it's opened that up. But, you know...
When you say it's opened that up, what is it?
The process of not caring what you say, but caring what you
yeah.
Is then transversing into, well, I killed the man, I shot him in the head, but I didn't mean to.
Yeah, in other words, mean, okay, then it comes down to meaning in that sense. Is what's your motive? Is it a politically correct motive? Was it a...
Well, but in my day, it was, are you a murderer or are you not?
Yeah, not an issue whether
you're a murderer. You were a murderer without taking anybody's life. Quill in hand and tear somebody up. You were a murderer.
And that was subject to trouble for you.
Or it's pest related.
Yeah. And so what is that? That's not, it's not, it's what you're, what are you, not what you're saying, it's what you mean. What do you mean now? Back then it's, what are you saying? Didn't matter what
whatever
you...
Whatever you said, that's what you meant.
Yeah.
my God, get the erection.
So the now do you Did James Joyce have other lives, what we call reincarnation? The spirit that had the life of James Joyce, does it spill into other lives?
Yes, it absolutely does that, but it does not in whole do that.
Not in whole?
Not in whole. It's always a part. It's the milk syndrome.
Right, so that the larger whole is the collective milk, but it's also the part that doesn't reincarnate. It observes it.
Yes, it's just pasteurized.
Yeah. Okay, wait a minute. What's pasteurized? The parts, lives?
The milk.
Yes, the older, the larger self is pasteurized, right. Yeah.
Yes, and it becomes a homogeneous part. And so, therefore, those new ones coming are part of him and me and you.
Yeah.
And that is, that's the non-physical part. But there's not where one scoop is in and one scoop is out.
Right, so the soul that you're part of, the larger that you're part of, what is that going to reincarnate next as, or are all the reincarnations already happening all at once anyways, as the Aries used to say, so it's meaningless for me to ask.
You can't get there dumping a glass of water in the ocean and taking a cup out. You don't get the same cup of water. But you may have a part of that cup of water,
but right.
It all becomes one.
So, the thing I'm talking to now, are you looking forward to reincarnating, to experiencing the physical?
Oh, there's nothing better than to be in physical form, knowing what you know now.
Knowing what you know now when you're in the non-physical.
Mm-hmm.
There's the Tom Waits line, I never knew the East Coast till I went to the West Coast.
That's correct.
Never knew the West Coast till I went to the East Coast. So, so you could say the people in the physical yearn for the non-physical, that's been the tradition, and that those in the non-physical yearn for the physical. Since there's thinning, that's going to become less of a characteristic of thinking.
That is correct. And the contrast that you experience in male becomes a larger brawl or a more symbiotic relationship with or ease of transition to the non-physical. 50 years ago, you start talking about non-physical and people leave the room quietly.
Yeah.
recognizing it.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's going to be interesting is that the more there's this thinning, the thing is to live in both at the same time. Then you get best of both worlds, right?
Yeah.
That's what we're moving towards. Going to the solid physical.
If you're creating, you want to go to the physical.
Yeah.
Because that's the leading edge. But if you don't have to, then you can't.
Right, and you still do it. Well, this gets into cosmic awareness's message channeled through.
Which is the same.
Which is what?
The same.
Yeah, well, they said the womb is closing. Yeah, but
so the birth canal is not getting smaller, but the placenta that holds the individual part is thinning. So if that's the case, then yes, the womb would be getting smaller, but that doesn't mean you're going to have smaller babies. That just means the separation between the host and the new child will be closer to one rather than a smaller womb, which would make more travail in the birth.
Yes, I'm going to address your philologist or etymologist self. Can you tell me where the word Rhyee, R-H-Y-E-E, came from, if it came from any place other than Ralph Doobie or Dave Worster's imagination?
Okay, I think it was developed. I think it was developed. I think it was a part that they were bumping into, that they allowed into their consciousness. There is reference with the civilization, which you call the folks from Easter Island.
Yes, Paul. Right. Okay, the second point is McLuhan, you know, made the word tactile or tactility popular. It's a favorite word. The word tactile in the published Fitting His Wake shows up at least once. And were you aware when you used that word that I think it was the art critic Wolfinger? Wolflin? Yeah, Wolflin.
Wolflin.
Yeah, Wolflin used it. You know, in the 1880s, 1890s, that transition period, and it became a key word. Was that, were you aware of Wolflin's popularization of the tactile? Was it part of the art speech of your younger, say, when you were in your 30s and 40s? Yeah.
Because it wasn't developing in that day.
But he, it was known to the degree one read, the kind of educated person who read his book, they would use that word. I mean, I think Peggy Guggenheim quotes, or it's sort of implied in Bernard Berenson's talk, that art was for, no longer for the retina. Is that the quote? I'm not sure. Something.
Yes.
It was not just retinal impression, something like
no,
that.
No, it was the it's more like an optic revolution or
revolution. R-E-V is in Victor.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, we have a critic today called Rosalind Krauss who did a book in the 90s called The Optical Unconscious, which sort of reviewed the hidden agenda of non-retinal communication in modern 20th century art.
First grade for black folks.
In the sense of... No, don't know what you mean. Are you bringing in race here? Are you being politically incorrect?
No.
Therefore, they could respond to the work.
Exactly as adequately as those that were sighted and missing the hidden, embedded part of the art.
Well, you know, blacks were the invisible when there was segregation. And also blacks, and this gets into McLuhan, they're acoustic, tactile people. So most of the 20th century was for black people. And that became known by the 60s, 70s, became more conscious, called black power and black celebrity. Here, McLuhan used to say that in the 20s, the Esperanto movement or the any kind of movement that was trying to unite the cultures around language did not notice that the blacks united the world through jazz. And then the whites wanted to reintegrate them into the subculture of literacy. But the blacks thought by the 50s that they should go the route of literacy, trying to get jobs there, but the post-literate was coming in, the post-industrial society, Therefore, the blacks couldn't get their literate jobs anymore. Which then reminds me of Obama, who's a highly literate person, projecting rearview mirror literate values on the present tactile, visceral bitch crisis we're in. He's a very nostalgic figure for American consciousness. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I hope it serves him well.
It could.
It could.
Everybody is equal in their contributions they can make as their chaos, as their individual chaos butterflies.
Cocoons.
Cocoons. Yeah. You know the joke McLuhan said about the, he used to say, the caterpillar looked at the butterfly and says, "You'll never get me up in one of those contraptions."
Right, right.
That's going to the non-physical. I don't know, is there any writer you're intrigued with today?
No.
Is there any entertainer in any medium or any artist that you're intrigued with? Would you think of Frank? Could you hear Frank Zappa's music in the non-physical?
The vibration, yes. The vibration that it took to create that work came from non-physical, so therefore it resonates there.
Well, all work does, right?
Yeah, but you're asking specifically what happened.
Well, maybe if you can draw it stronger from it, it makes it a greater art.
If you resonate with it, you see.
Yeah, if you resonate with his music.
Yeah.
Did you resonate with, did you resonate with it?
Yeah.
But I would say maybe not, since you liked opera and were well trained in 19th century, so sort of.
Well, I understand, but he pulled from that same girth.
Yeah.
His was more out there, but it was very trained.
Yes.
Very trained. It wasn't just this acid rock business that had no meaning of anything.
Yes.
It was orchestrated.
You're right. Here's what a writer of Zappa books, Ben Watson, likes this statement. I say that Frank Zappa showed discipline to those that celebrated lack of discipline. And he showed freedom to those that overrated discipline.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Precisely.
And that's what you did with Finnegan's Wake.
That was the hope.
That was the hope, yeah. So my phone's starting to blink, and that means the battery's starting to go down. It could go on for another half hour, but is there anything you'd like to say? What do you advise me and Carolyn as we create the leading edge of thinning?
the best, we are thrilled with the interaction. We are delighted with the capacity of the hinting and drawing and asking and wanting and the never-ending desire of achieving completion that we don't complete. It's delightful. Energizing and refreshing as we usher into the new processes that have just now come forth from non-physical, and that we now have the new ability and capacity, if it's our wanting, to come to a new area. If it's a moving mass force that's not going to be stopped, if not through you, it'd be through someone else. So why not you? We are extremely appreciative and have much gratitude for the extension of the opportunity is to engage. Very, very, very refreshing. Very incredibly refreshing.
Well, that's great. And are there how many watching and listening to us there? So my old buddies, Dr. Beter, Mae Brussel, Zappa, they're all hanging, McLuhan, they're all there. They must have a front row seat since they knew me. Well, thank you very much, and we thank our vehicle, JW, for doing this. And
we are complete.
We are complete. We've actually arrived.